For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're going to be looking at Luke chapter 19, verses 28 through 44, which I entitled Recognizing the Time of His Coming. I'm actually pulling directly from what Jesus says in Luke 19, verse 44, because really you look at Jesus' ministry and it was characterized by misunderstanding. The people who encountered Jesus often thought that he was someone who he really wasn't. Let's look at our passage in Luke 19, starting in verse 28. Jesus went out on toward Jerusalem, walking ahead of his disciples. As he came to the towns of Bethphage and Bethany on the Mount of Olives, he sent two disciples ahead. "Go into the village over there," he told them, "and as you enter it, you'll see a young donkey tied there that no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks, 'Why are you untying that colt?' just say, 'The Lord needs it.'" And they went and found the colt just as Jesus said. So if you're unfamiliar with animals, a colt is actually, you know, a baby donkey that's under 4 years old. And sure enough, as they were untying it, the owners asked them, "Why are you untying that colt?" And the disciples said, "The Lord needs it." And so they brought the colt to Jesus and threw their garments over him to ride on. And he rode along, and the crowd spread out their garments on the road ahead of him. When he reached the place where the road started down the Mount of Olives, all of his followers began to shout and sing as they walked along, praising God for all the wonderful miracles they had seen. "Blessings on the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven." What they're doing here is they're singing a psalm, Psalm 118, which was a messianic psalm. Now, this was a song that they were supposed to sing at the arrival of King Messiah. And so they anticipated that this, you know, guy, Jesus, by riding into the city of Jerusalem on a donkey, that was signaling that he was indeed King Messiah. But some of the Pharisees among the crowd said, "Teacher, rebuke your followers for saying things like that." And he replied, if they keep quiet, the stones along the road would burst into cheers." And so Jesus refused to tell his disciples and the audience to stop saying this, which is sort of unusual if you know anything about Jesus' career up to this point. You know, often Jesus told people to keep silent about his identity. Throughout the Gospels, you'll notice that people will make a proclamation of Jesus' identity and hit the mark that he indeed was the Son of God, and he'd be like, "Okay, now keep quiet about that." Or he'd perform a miracle, and people would start going out proclaiming what he had done, and he would say, no, just don't tell people about what happened here. In fact, in one case, Peter, one of the disciples, was confused about Jesus' identity, and so Jesus confronts him and says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter says, "Well, you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said, "Blessed are you, Peter, son of John, for flesh and blood have not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." And with that, he told him not to tell anybody about his identity. So it's sort of weird that Jesus would ask that kind of question and then respond that way when Peter gets the answer right. Sort of like, "Who do you say that I am?" "Oh, you're the Messiah. Good, now shut up." But the reason Jesus did this was he wanted to make sure that when he would be brought before the crowds, the audience, as the Messiah, that it was his time. Because he knew what was going to happen, that once people recognized him for who he really was, that they would eventually crucify him. And so he didn't want to hasten his crucifixion because he knew that it wasn't within God's plan. And so Jesus often pursued this secrecy throughout his ministry. But in this case, he takes sort of a different stand. He doesn't keep the people quiet. And by doing so, Jesus was really claiming to be the Messiah by refusing to tell the people to stop. He was essentially coming out as the King Messiah that everybody was anticipating. You know, during this time, the Romans occupied Israel, and the Israelites were under their rule. And so they were looking forward to a liberator, a deliverer. And they knew of a figure in the Old Testament, someone who was named the Anointed One or Messiah, who would one day come and liberate God's people and bring salvation to the entire world. And so it raises the question, you know, what was Jesus doing here? Well, first of all, he was staging what you might call a triumphal entry. In the ancient world, whenever a general or a king had a successful campaign, they would stage what's called a triumphal entry, where they would ride through the city either on a chariot or they would be on a large charger, you know, a white charger, that he would march through the city, and the people would lay their cloaks on the ground and they would wave these palm branches to salute his victory. And in Greek, this is the word parousia, which means coming. And so Jesus was staging a triumphal entry as the King of Israel. And everybody would have recognized it as such. And so the crowd probably viewed Jesus as their liberator. This was the Anointed One that God promised would come, whom he predicted long ago, hundreds of years in the past, that this guy would emerge who was going to be a conquering king. And so they must have been thrilled that finally we get to throw off the yoke of oppression that the Romans have thrown upon us, and that God is going to lead his people as an independent nation. But Jesus' triumphal entry contains some odd details. You know, I mentioned that typically a successful general would come in on a large charger. But Jesus was on a donkey. And not just a donkey, but a colt of a donkey. In fact, other accounts say a foal of a donkey, which is even younger than 4 years old. That's a donkey that's less than a year old. And I don't know if you've ever seen a donkey before, but they're not really big. And a foal of a donkey must have been tiny. So, you know, this would have been like somebody riding a dog, like a St. Bernard, you know, with their feet dragging. It's not really that impressive, right? Not what you would expect for a conquering king. Another really odd detail comes to us in verse 41. As Jesus came closer to Jerusalem and saw the city ahead, he began to weep. Not really the kind of thing that you would see from someone who is getting this acclaim. It's not really the reaction you would anticipate from Jesus, that he would start weeping as he saw the crowds cheering for him. And it really doesn't make much sense either, considering Jesus up to this point had been holding a pretty important secret, maybe the juiciest secret in the universe, to himself for about 3 years. That he was indeed the king, the Messiah. You know, it's kind of like when you're sitting there with a secret, it's really hard to hold it in. It's kind of like trying to hold in a pea. You know, you just feel like you're going to burst at any moment. And so I'm sure that that must have been agonizing for Jesus to hold on to this really important secret. And yet, now that he's come out and told everybody about his identity, you would think that he would feel a sense of relief, and yet he feels grief and bitterness over this. And I think part of the reason for this is that Jesus understood that these same people who were yelling Hosanna in the highest, which means blessed, would be the same people just a few days later who would be yelling out, crucify, crucify him. That a lot of them had superficial faith. That they wanted somebody who was a conquering king, but weren't anticipating a suffering servant, somebody who was going to pay for all of their sins. And really, you see this in our day today, that we want to try to shape God or Jesus into something that fits our imagination, something that fits conveniently with what we want in our lives. Typically, someone who is pretty far removed from our lives but gives us endless blessing. And so we see that these people had some of the same problems even in Jesus' own day. Well, Jesus goes on, he says, "How I wish today that all of you people would understand the way of peace, but now it's too late, and peace is hidden from your eyes." Just like it is today, it was back then, people were hoping that a political movement would eventually bring peace to the world. And Jesus knows better. He knows that the only thing that can truly bring peace is God and the salvation that he imparts through Jesus. Before long, your enemies will build ramparts against your walls and encircle you and close you in from every side. So Jesus starts to prophesy about this coming time where Jerusalem will be sieged. They're going to build these big ramparts and eventually encircle the city, hem it in completely. And he says they will crush you to the ground and your children with you, and your enemies will not leave a single stone in place because you didn't recognize the time of God's coming. And so Jesus says, because you missed this, because you misidentified who I am, it's going to cost you. And about 40 years later, this actually was fulfilled when Titus came into the city and actually leveled the city in about 70 AD. In fact, the Romans were so zealous to try to send a message to their occupied territories that this is what happens to you if you mess with Rome, that they actually deconstructed the city so that what Jesus said was actually true, that not even one stone was on top of another. And if you've ever been to Israel, you know that that is pretty incredible, that claim. Because some of these stones are, 20 feet wide and 5 feet tall. I mean, these things must weigh, several tons. And so the Romans deconstructed the city to send a message to anybody else. This is what's going to happen to you if you mess with us. But Jesus points out that this was part of God's judgment upon those people for misidentifying or not recognizing the time of Christ's coming. Now, I think that in a way, what these guys were missing was what God has outlined really throughout the Old Testament. If you ever study the Old Testament, you'll find that there are some 300 Old Testament prophecies in the form of typological prophecy. So you'll have, like, for example, the sacrificial system outlined in the book of Leviticus. And if you study each and every one of those details, you'll notice that there are corresponding symbols to what Christ has done. And if you ever study it, I'm sure you'll be amazed at how interesting they are and how God, hundreds and in cases thousands of years in advance, was predicting the coming of his son Jesus. And God did this because he knew that there are going to be so many competing voices out there claiming to speak for him. You know, I remember as a non-Christian person, one of the things that was very confusing was trying to sort through all the different world religions out there. It's really confusing to try to figure out, okay, if there is even a right religion out there, how do I know that this one is the correct one? Maybe what, some people say that all religions sort of lead to the top of the mountain. Maybe they're right. Maybe there isn't one true religion, but that there are different forms of religion that ultimately lead to the same God. And so it's very confusing. And God, I think, anticipated that this was going to happen. And so he laid out these prophecies in order to pre-authenticate the coming of his son Jesus. In fact, we see in Isaiah 42, verse 8 and 9, God explicitly says this. He says, "I am the Lord, that is my name. I'm not going to give my glory to anyone else, nor share my praise with carved idols." And so he points out in verse 9 that he predicts the future before it comes to pass, so that they will know that he indeed is God. And so God anticipated this and left us artifacts throughout the Old Testament that point to details of his son's coming, his son's life, and eventually his son's death. In fact, this event here, the triumphal entry, was actually predicted in the Old Testament in Zechariah 9, verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. And of course, the details later point to him riding on the colt of a donkey, the foal of a donkey. And so that's why the people, when they saw Jesus riding into the streets of Jerusalem on a donkey, they immediately recognized that this was a fulfillment of Zechariah 9, verse 9. Now, okay, if you're sitting here as maybe a skeptic or a visitor, you might be thinking to yourself, well, I mean, that's pretty amazing that Zechariah 9:9 predicts that some individual would mount a donkey, a foal of a donkey, and walk into, or, you know, drag his feet along, I guess, in Jerusalem, riding this donkey. But couldn't somebody just, like, read that prophecy in the Old Testament, which was available to everyone, and say, you know what, I want to claim to be the Messiah, so I'm going to jump on top of this donkey and ride into Jerusalem? That's plausible, right? But at the same time, you have to understand that, like, not just anybody could have done this, where they just jumped on a donkey and that people would have accepted that person as the Messiah. You know, the reason it was so believable for Jesus was that he was performing all these different miracles over the last, you know, 3 years that the people saw with their own eyes. And so this sort of signaled, okay, he really is the Messiah, even though people had been just merely speculating about it up to that point. But obviously, as modern readers, that's not available to us. We weren't there when Jesus turned water into wine. We weren't there when he raised Lazarus from the dead. And so a skeptic, rightfully, I would say, could say, well, you know, it's easy for somebody to self-fulfill this. But there are prophecies in the Old Testament that would be impossible to deliberately fulfill. It would be impossible to do that. And one of the prophecies I want to show you tonight relates to this event, the triumphal entry, and accurately predicts Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem 500 years before it actually happened. Now, it's important for us to set a target for where we're aiming. We need to know when Jesus entered into Jerusalem riding this donkey. And so let's try to work through this real quick. Okay, this part that we're jumping into, it's going to be a little bit technical. There's going to be a lot of details. It might get a little bit confusing. But we're just going to have to gird ourselves and hang on, okay? Because I promise you the payoff is going to be good. But your head might be swimming a little bit during parts of the rest of this teaching here. But please hang on, because I think it's going to be a good payoff. Okay, so Christ's entrance into Jerusalem. First of all, we know that the Gospels tell us that Pontius Pilate crucified Jesus. Okay, that's a fact. Hardly anyone disputes that. In fact, I don't know of one voice that disputes this historical fact. Now, we know that Jesus rode into Jerusalem just a few days before he was crucified. So, if we could land this date for when Pontius Pilate crucified Jesus, then we'll also have the date for Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. Now, John 18, verse 28 through 29 tells us that the Jewish leaders took Jesus from Caiaphas, the high priest at the time, to the palace of the Roman governor. And so Pilate came out to them and asked, "What charges are you bringing against this man?" So John the apostle lays the responsibility of Jesus' crucifixion solely in Pilate's hands. That he was the one who was in charge and had the authority to do this. Now, if you go to Wikipedia, you know, Pontius Pilate served as the procurator of Judea in AD 26 through 36. So he had a 10-year career there. And so that gives us sort of a narrow window which we can work to try to figure out Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem. Secondly, Passover only fell on four Fridays from AD 26 through 36. One detail that the Gospels give us is that Jesus actually was crucified on the eve of Passover. And so we know from trying to line up the solar and lunar calendar, because the Jewish calendar runs on the lunar calendar, meaning that it goes by when the moon rises, not by when the sun rises. And we know that when you compare the solar and lunar calendar, that there were only four Fridays on which Passover fell. And they are AD 27, AD 30, AD 33, and AD 36, so every 3 years. Now, another detail that the Gospels give us is that Herod's temple had been standing for 46 years when Jesus cleansed the temple. That's a detail that we get from John 2, verse 20, where Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, in 3 days I'm going to destroy this temple and raise it up." And the Pharisees and the teachers of the law started scoffing at him and said, "It took Herod 46 years to build this temple." And the term that they use for rebuild could also mean to rebuild, because we know that the second temple was actually standing when Herod started his construction on the temple. And so he just actually beautified the temple and made it even more grand than what it was. And so that took 46 years. Now we know from historical sources when Herod began his building project on the temple, and it was in 19 AD. And so you take 46 years from 19 AD and you end up with AD 29. So Jesus must have cleansed the temple and began his ministry after AD 29. So from there you can eliminate AD 27, right? And then the final detail is that John records four Passovers that went on during Jesus' ministry. And that's how we get an idea that Jesus' ministry lasted for about 3 to 3.5 years. So from this, we can start to eliminate different dates. Obviously, the cleansing of the temple happened in AD 29, and so we can eliminate AD 27. And since there are four recorded Passovers in the Gospel of John, we can also eliminate AD 36. Now that leaves the two best dates for Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem, which is AD 30 and AD 33. But if John records four Passovers during Jesus' ministry, then, and also Jesus cleansed the temple in AD 29, then the best date for Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem is probably AD 33. And so that, I think, is the best date for Jesus' entry into Jerusalem and his crucifixion. In fact, if you go to Wikipedia, they'll list AD 33 and AD 30 are as the best two dates for Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. Obviously, I favor AD 33 for the reasons I gave. Now, with that, we're going to jump into another complicated issue. An Old Testament prophecy that was given to us by Daniel the prophet. And this comes to us from Daniel chapter 9. Now, a little bit of background on this. You know, Daniel was brought into Babylon in 605 BC because the Babylonians attacked the southern kingdom of Israel, completely decimated the land, and then exported some of the royalty into Babylon. They sort of had this catch and release program where they would take the young nobles, indoctrinate them, and then send them back into their own land as the rulers. Because they spoke the language, they knew the culture, but they were brainwashed with Babylonian ideals. And so Daniel was sitting in Babylon as an exile, and he's sitting there praying to God, asking God how long they're going to be in captivity. And he falls into a trance, and an angel speaks to him. And so that's the context of Daniel chapter 9. Now, when we skip down to Daniel 9, verse 24, we get the prophecy that we want to look at. Daniel 9, 24 says, 77s are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the whole most holy place. So, these 77s actually cover the entire scope of human history to the very end. Now, we know that some of these things have been fulfilled. For example, we're told that within these 77s, God will atone for wickedness, which happened when Christ died for us, that he paid for our sins. Also, that during this period, God will seal up vision and prophecy. And that's referring to God finalizing his revelation, his written word, the Bible. That's happened already. But there are some things on this list that have not been fulfilled yet. For example, to finish transgression, we see sin all the time, so we know that that hasn't happened yet. And to bring in everlasting righteousness. Again, that hasn't happened. So, some of these things have been fulfilled, others haven't. Well, it does raise this question, though. What is Daniel talking about when he prophesies that there are 77s? Because this is going to be helpful for us trying to figure out the time frame that Daniel has in mind. Now, this word seven is the word Shabua, or Shabuim in Hebrew. And it can either refer to 7 days, or it can also refer to 7 years. Context is what really determines whether you read it as years or days. Now, we need to remember that Daniel is sitting here pondering when God is going to bring them back into the land, because they had been there for a number of years. Now, when we look at the Old Testament, God actually had given a number of laws that related to what Daniel has in mind. In Leviticus 25, verse 3 and 4, God decreed, for 6 years, sow your fields, and for 6 years, prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the 7th year, the land is to have a year of Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Don't sow your fields or prune your vineyards. This word, the point of this here, the 7th year, is what is the same word as seven, same root. Now, the point of this is that God wanted them to, you know, plant in their field for 6 years and reap the harvest. But then on the 7th year, they were to leave the ground fallow. They weren't supposed to plant anything, trusting that God would provide in the previous years so that they had enough to survive on the 7th year. Now, even though I'm sure that some people were willing to try this out, a lot of people weren't very happy with this law, because you could lose some serious income by, you know, simply not planting 1 year. And so as a result, a lot of people decided they weren't going to follow this. And God made a very specific, command that they should do this. And if they didn't, there would be some serious repercussions. In Leviticus 26, verse 33 and 34, the next chapter, God says, your land will be laid waste and your cities will lie in ruins if they didn't follow this Sabbath rest law. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate, and you're in the country of your enemies. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbath rests. So he's saying, you know, If you guys decide that you want to ignore this law, if you decide to defy me on this, then you know what? Since you didn't keep the Sabbath law, I'll keep it for you. I'll send you on a little vacation up to Babylon. And it's not going to be fun. And, you know, I'll let the land rest that way. Now, we know that this was the reason why Daniel and the Israelites were in Babylon, because in 2 Chronicles 36, verse 20 and 21, we're told those who had escaped from the sword, he carried away to Babylon to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah until the land had enjoyed its Sabbath rest. All the days of its desolation, it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. And so the author of Chronicles actually gives us the explicit reason why they are there for 70 years. Of course, there were other things that they were doing, such as mistreating the poor. They were worshiping idols. But it might be that they God chose the Sabbath rest as sort of the sentence for how long they would be in Babylon. And so this gives us the context then for what these 77s are, that they're 70 years. Now, in Daniel 9:25, Daniel goes on to say, "No one understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble." So if you notice, there are only 69 sevens. In Daniel 9:26 and 27, it talks about the last seven, which happens at the end of time. But he says that from this issuing of the decree to restore Jerusalem until the anointed one comes, the anointed one is the Messiah. It's actually the word Mashiach in Hebrew, which is what we transliterate Messiah, the anointed one. There will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. So the key words or phrases to look at here are, from the issuing of the decree until the anointed one, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Now, if you're anything like me, you're a visual learner, so I like to sort of graph things out. And maybe we could look at this on a timeline to clarify it some. So if you break this down into a timeline, Daniel 9:25, you've got, from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. Now we're going to do a little bit of math here, okay? And if you're a skeptical person and you're not sure if there's going to be some funny business in these numbers, you can bust out your phone and start using your calculator as we go through these computations. Now, seven sevens, 7 times 7 equals 49, okay? Sorry for those of you who are humanities majors, I'm sure that you're a little... Hey, I was a humanities major too, it's okay. We have to admit our limitations. And 62 sevens, which is 62 times 7 equals 434. Add those together and you get 483 years, okay? Now, remember I said that the Jewish calendar is in lunar years, which is a difference of about 5 days. There are 360 days in a lunar calendar, whereas according to the Julian calendar, our calendar, there's 365 days. And so in order for this date to land in the Julian calendar, we need to do a little bit of conversion. So if you convert the Hebrew lunar years to Julian solar years, you have 360 days times 483, and you have a raw number of 173,880 days. Divide that by 365, and you get 476 years. So that's the time span that the prophecy gives us. There's going to be 476 years from the issuing of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah comes, the anointed one. Okay? Now, The only thing we really need then is to anchor this span of time to the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. And luckily, the Bible contains that too. In Nehemiah chapter 2. Now, this is, you know, fast forward a couple hundred years, and Nehemiah is the cupbearer for King Artaxerxes, who at this point is the Persian king. And we're told early the following spring in the month of Nisan, during the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, I was serving the king his wine. Now, Nehemiah was a cupbearer, and you know, his job was to taste the king's wine. Not for the quality of the wine, but to make sure that there wasn't any poison in it, because kings were often worried about, you know, political intrigue. And so there was somebody whose job was solely to drink some wine for the king and to make sure it wasn't poison. So it was a pretty good gig for Nehemiah. You know, all he had to do was drink all day and live, I guess. And he said, I had never before appeared sad in the king's presence. So the king asked me, he said, why are you look so sad? Is everything okay? Why don't you take a seat? He says, you don't look sick to me. You must be deeply troubled. Then I was terrified, but I replied, long live the king. How can I not be sad? For the city where my ancestors are buried is in ruins, and the gates have been destroyed by fire. Referring back to the event in 586 BC when the Babylonians decimated Jerusalem. The king asked, well, how can I help you? With a prayer to the God of heaven, you know, so he shoots up a prayer real quick. He says, okay, if it pleases the king, and if you're pleased with me, your servant, send me to Judah to rebuild the city where my ancestors are buried. Well, the king, with the queen sitting beside me, asked, well, how long will you be gone? How long? Well, when are you going to return? And after I told him how long we would be gone, the king agreed to my request. So this was a significant turning point for the nation of Israel, where the king decreed the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And Nehemiah, since he had so much success with that, was like, well, maybe I should ask for a little bit more. I also said to the king, if it pleases the king, let me have letters addressed to the governors of the province west of the Euphrates, instructing them to let me have safe travel through their territories on my way to Judea. So he's like, give me a letter authorizing me to go back to my land, so that way if people attack me, I can just say, look, I'm on orders from the king to go and rebuild Jerusalem. And of course, the king granted him that request as well. And he's like, well, you know, since we're at it, please give me a letter addressed to Asaph, the manager of the king's forest, instructing him to give me some timber. I'm going to need to make beams for the gates of the temple fortress, for the city walls, and for the house for myself. And so he's like, can you throw in a Lowe's gift card too for all the building materials? And the king granted these requests because the gracious hand of God was on me. Okay, so this is the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Now, we're told that this was in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, in the spring, in Nisan. Okay, so we have a chronological marker. But we still need to figure out when King Artaxerxes reigned. Luckily, again, our trusty website here, Wikipedia, actually tells us, and this is based on archaeological evidence, pretty complete archaeological evidence of the Persian and Babylonian reign that they uncovered in the Euphrates Valley there, that King Artaxerxes Longimanus, which means lefty, I guess there is a lore that his left hand was bigger and longer than his right hand. So I guess he had like a kind of a weird hand thing. But that he actually reigned from 465 BC to 424 BC. So it was in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign in the spring. And so if we go back to our timeline here, we have the dating of the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. You have 465 BC, which is the beginning of Artaxerxes' reign. And then you subtract 20. Remember, this is in BC, so the numbers go down. The 20th year of his reign would be 445 BC. Now, We also have to subtract yet another year because the month of Nisan is actually in the spring. And if you line up the Hebrew and Julian calendar, it actually, the month of Nisan, or the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, is actually a year ahead. Because the Persians actually viewed fall as the beginning of their new year. And so you have to add or subtract another year, and that gives you 444 BC, which is the best dating for the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Okay. Now it's all starting to come together. If you're losing it a little bit, hang in there, okay? We're almost there. Now, from this, we can calculate the arrival of the Anointed One, the Messiah, coming into Jerusalem. You have 444 BC plus 476, and that leads to AD 32. Pretty good, but a year short, right? Remember we said 33 AD is our target date? Well, as it turns out, you also have to add yet another year because there's no zero year. You know, unlike a number line where you have like negative 1, 0, 1, 2, in the Julian calendar, it goes from 1 BC to 81. And so you have to add another year, which gives us AD 33. Pretty remarkable. I remember encountering this for the very first time as a non-Christian person. I was very skeptical. And I read, actually, Daniel 9 laid out in a book that I was reading. And that prophecy, along with a couple others in the book of Isaiah and also in the book of Psalms, were the things that catapulted me into faith. I mean, I just remember seeing this for the very first time and reading through it and my jaw literally dropping to the ground and just saying to myself, I cannot believe that this is right. This is real. And you know, I grew up in a church where I believed that there was no evidence at all for God. It was just blind faith. And then to come to find out that there's real evidence for belief in Christianity solidified what I was already inclined to think, that God is real and that He has spoken in human history. Well, you know, if you look at this, it's an incredible prophecy where Daniel predicts Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem nearly 500 years in advance. That's what we're talking about here. Now, the skeptical side of you might say, well, there might be some explanations for this. So I think it'd be worthwhile for us to review some possible naturalistic explanations. You know, one would be, what if Christians inserted this passage in the Old Testament after the fact? Good point. Well, in the late 1940s, there was an incredible discovery called the Dead Sea Scrolls, where we've uncovered 8 small fragments from the book of Daniel. The earliest dating to 125 BC. Now, even though people dispute when the book of Daniel was written, what's not disputed is that it was written before Christ even existed. And so that's impossible for Christians to insert this passage back into the Old Testament. Very unlikely. What if the New Testament writers made Jesus' triumphal entry line up with this prediction? Yeah. You know, you can imagine the disciples thinking to themselves, okay, well, you know, so there's that prophecy in Daniel 9, it's 33 AD, it's, you know, I think that's about 483 years later. Okay, this year it's the right time for us to say that Jesus, you know, rode into Jerusalem to make it seem like Jesus was really the Messiah. Well, again, I think that's highly unlikely for a number of reasons. First of all, it would be really unlikely for the disciples to be able to calculate the exact year of this prophecy's fulfillment. You know, first of all, the disciples never say, well, Jesus rode into Jerusalem in AD 33. It never says that in the New Testament. there are these chronological markers that they lay out throughout the gospel, such as this was during the reign of Tiberius, or that this was during Pontius Pilate's governing of Judea, where we get AD 33. In fact, Josephus, one of the great historians and scholars of the first century, looked at Daniel 9, verse 25 through 27, and saw its fulfillment in Tiberius in AD 70 when he destroyed the temple. And so here was a guy who was one of the great intellectuals of the first century who thought that it was an event that happened 40 years later. And so it seems very unlikely that these disciples would have been able to calculate the exact year of this prophecy's fulfillment. Secondly, the disciples never tell us that Jesus died in AD 33. I sort of mentioned that already. We get these chronological markers that tell us that it is in AD 33. And so for the disciples to try to fabricate this, to be like, oh, okay, I'm sure that people hundreds of years later are going to read this. So we should include that little bit about Pontius Pilate so that they know that it's at least within that narrow 10-year window. And we should probably throw in that there were four Passovers so that people can sort of deduce that it wasn't, an AD 27 or AD 36, but it's probably somewhere between AD 30 and 33. We should also add that other detail too about the Passover falling on Friday. That'd be real good. That would be such an elaborate fabrication. The other thing is, why would they lie about this? Why would they try to make Jesus the Messiah? After all, if you look at their lives, after Jesus was crucified and raised from the dead, what happened to them? They were beaten, they were persecuted, many of them lived impoverished lives. In fact, extra-biblical authors tell us that all but one of the disciples actually were executed for their faith. And so what material advantage, what power advantage did they get from saying that Jesus was the Messiah? It doesn't make any sense. The other thing is, we don't even need the New Testament to show that God fulfilled this prediction. Oh yeah, if you just rip the New Testament out of your Bible and threw it out, you could still figure out that Daniel 9 was predicted or fulfilled in Jesus, because we have a number of extra biblical sources that attest to Jesus dying in AD 33. For example, Tacitus in his Annals 15 verse 44 says, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite torture on a class hated for their abominations called Christians. Christus, from whom they name the name has its origin, suffered the extreme penalty under the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. Tacitus was not a Christian. He was not sympathetic to Christianity. Josephus, who we mentioned was one of the great historians of the first century in his Jewish Antiquities, says, now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, and he drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross. And so he names Pilate as the one driving Jesus' crucifixion. And then sometime later, the Babylonian Talmud, a Jewish source, again, not sympathetic to Christianity, says, on the eve of the Passover, Yeshua, which is Jesus, was hanged, which was another term that they would use for crucifixion. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went and cried forth, he's going forth to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who can say anything in his favor, let him come forward and plead on his behalf. But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. So even without the New Testament, we can tell that Jesus was indeed crucified in AD 33. Pretty amazing. And so it would be nearly impossible for the New Testament authors to fake this fulfillment. It's inconceivable that that would happen. And you know, there's a lack of motive too. Why would they do that? What advantage did they gain? I think the best explanation, the most plausible explanation, is that God predicted and fulfilled this prophecy. Takeaway. Yeah. Let's wrap this up. I think the first thing is that God has given us objective evidence for belief in His Son. You know, some of you, like I mentioned, have come in here, you're skeptical, you're not sure you believe in Christianity. There's evidence out there. And this is just one of many prophecies that God has laid out for you to see and also to be able to hang your faith on something that's real, something objective. You know, so if you're a little bit skeptical, I'm sure that, you know, even though this prophecy might be pretty amazing, is it going to change your life tonight? Maybe. But at the very least, I think that it could compel you to turn to God and ask Him for the remaining evidence. You know, this isn't just an intellectual thing. It's about having a personal relationship with God. And, you know, if you're not sure if God exists, if you're not sure that He's real, but feel like this is pretty good evidence, maybe your next move would be to call out to God and ask Him if He's real. To have a personal encounter with Him. You know, for those of us who have maybe been around for a while, we've been investigating Christianity, don't make the same mistake Jesus' audience made by failing to recognize the time of His coming. You know, the audience of the first century was facing judgment. And Jesus said that the reason that they experienced that judgment was because they failed to realize His coming. And in the same way, we face judgment because of our moral guilt. A judgment that's really far worse than what they experienced in AD 70. But God, in His love and mercy, sent His Son Jesus to come and die for us so that we could be forgiven. And if we recognize the time of His coming and turn to Him in faith, God says that we can have a relationship with Him that will never end, and that we can avoid that judgment. Yeah, Lord, there's so much more at stake here than just, you know, this being some sort of intellectual exercise. That really it's the difference between believing in You, which can bring eternal life, or choosing to deny You, or just never deciding for You, which ultimately leads to judgment. And we thank You that You've made Your mercy and love available to us through Christ, and that You've gone so far as to pre-authenticate the coming of Your Son in so many ways. And I pray if, you know, for those of us who are seekers, God, who may be intrigued by what we heard tonight, that we would in our hearts just turn to You and ask if You're real, and to show Yourself to us. We know that You're real, that You're a living being, and that You're going to answer that prayer. And for those of us who don't know You, Lord, and may have done some investigation and may feel convinced that maybe this is the truth, that we would have the courage to place our trust in You and receive what Christ has paid through the cross. And we thank You for anyone who did that. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.